So now let's go start with the pay cap for what you can pay under contractor salaries. I know you worked with the congressional committees to try to massage that before it passed. What did we end up with?
Well, we ended up with something sort of in between, but it looked a lot like what the House and the Senate started with. The provision extends the cap to all contractor employees of any company working on a cost-type contract. But it did not change, which was our position. We had asked, and they agreed, that the statutory formula with the incremental inflationary increase be preserved. So that's what we ended up with. It covers more employees, but the formula is still in place. We don't think this is the last conversation we're going to have on this provision, though. I expect to visit it next year.
Well, what is the effect of it in terms of contracting?
Well, the direct effect is that companies are going to have to cover a larger percentage of their employee salaries directly out of corporate profits. The underlying reason for doing this in the first place was because Congress recognized a discrepancy and an inequity between what skill sets could get compensated for in the commercial sector and the private sector, and desired to create a compensation package that was at least in some ways comparable on the public sector side, so that those highly skilled people, the best and the brightest, would be attracted to working on public sector programs. And so that was that reason, that need is still in place. And what companies are going to have to do for more of their employees to be able to sustain those compensation packages that match what the commercial companies pay is, pay for more of it out of their own corporate profits.
One thing about this provision, however, is that it's only for cost-type contracts, so labor hours, time and materials, even firm fixed price. Does the provision apply to those types of contracts?
It does not apply. It only applies under, a cost accounting system. So under a firm fixed price contract, for example, which is y'all have discussed it at length, is a major drive for the government to push contracting into fixed price contracts. Those are not covered here, and the salary, the compensation packages of the employees, it's all part of a fixed price. It's all part of a specified set of deliverables.
All right, so it has pretty widespread effect then, in other words.
Well, it's going to impact anything that has a cost-type contract on it or is being done under a cost-type contract. And the cost for companies could be quite substantial depending upon how many, depending upon the mix of the contract types in their portfolio. For the government, as we discussed before, Tom, there is no recognizable savings. There's no money back to Treasury by doing this because of the color of money issues associated with this and the fact that this is not actually reducing the government's obligations. It's simply moving the money around, if you will.
But won't the vendors just kind of fix their G&A, their overhead, and kind of recharge the government to make up for that loss in potential profit? So, for instance, if there was $1,000 they were paying them, now they can only pay $500. Can't they just kind of recharge the government? I mean, won't the government end up paying in the end anyways?
Not necessarily. Well, they may pay in the end with a higher price because it costs the company more to just deliver a good or service. It may drive the price of the product, but it will not be something that they can move the money around into a different category and make it allowable again. It's either allowable in this form or it's not. But it very well could drive the cost of the goods and services that all companies, this is universal. So in the end, the government may pay more for goods and services as a result of this because the companies are now having to look at either absorbing those additional expenses themselves or passing those costs along on to whomever's buying their goods and services.
We are speaking with Trey Hodgkins, Senior Vice President for National Security and Procurement Policy at Tech America. Okay, so what else is in there that contractors need to know about besides the fact that it authorizes DOD?
Well, there were two other provisions in the bill that seemed to have generated a lot of interest from our members, Tom. One was around the counterfeit parts. Section 818 of the bill creates a new liability for companies that are integrating any electronic component. So this is down to resistors, capacitors, even the elemental components on an integrated circuit. If there's anything found to be counterfeit in any supply chain of any electronic device, whether it's a weapon system, an aircraft, an information technology, you know, an IT system, a network, all of those electronics are covered under this new provision. And what it says is that if you deliver it creates a risk-based approach or tries to create a risk-based approach to controlling the infiltration of counterfeit electronics into the DoD supply chain. Industry fully supports that objective. What we are concerned about is the way the liabilities that flow from this are going to be applied. We have no problems, as the bill spells out, that when one of our efforts to control counterfeits fails, contractors are fully willing to step up and replace that at their cost. That's a contract obligation, if nothing else. But what we have concerns about is when we don't control the supplier. For example, if the product or the element has to come out of a depot that the government owns and manages, and we're required to use that under the contract as a contractor, we're still on the hook if a counterfeit product is delivered and for all the costs associated with replacing that. So there's some liabilities that go beyond things that the contractor can control, and we had sought to try and mitigate some of that. That did not make it into the final language, and obviously we're going to continue to work with the Congress to try and perfect this in a way that, you know, again, we support trying to keep counterfeits out. We support a more robust mechanism. We support, for example, more robust reporting tools and websites and agencies that are out there, enhancing those so that people know where counterfeits come from.
Sure. So that sounds to me like on those two provisions, you're going to go back to Congress in the coming year to try to see if you can get some modifications for the 2013 authorization bill.
Well, on the executive comp, companies are, I think, believe that we ended up in the best position we probably could have given the debate that was going on. We're not going to seek additional changes to the executive comp provision. On the counterfeit provision, there are some liabilities that we believe are beyond the control of the contractor, and where we think that there can be some perfections made to the language to make sure that, you know, the contractor is actually liable for things that they can control, and that includes their entire supply chain. But when it's things that are beyond their control, like things that the government tells them they have to go and use a particular vendor or use a depot as a source for a component, and they still end up with a counterfeit component, then we think that, you know, that's a shared liability in those situations. And so some additional perfections on the language should be done.
Mr. Hodgkins, real quick, can't the vendor just write into the contract, negotiate into the contract a provision that says we're not responsible for a depot product?
Well, I mean, they can certainly try to negotiate that with the government, but now the government's perspective will be that they have a statute backing them up and preventing those kinds of clauses from being included in any contracts. So they don't have the latitude to exclude that. There may be some companies that are just simply unwilling to accept that kind of liability, and we caution the government about that, and we think that there will be companies, particularly those that are more heavily from the commercial sector, who may be suppliers to primes in the defense industrial base or to the federal government, who look at the potential liabilities and obligations they'd be signing up for, and they say, you know, it's not worth doing business.
Should be an interesting year. Trey Hodgkins is Senior VP for National Security and Procurement Policy at Tech America. Thanks for joining us with that update, and we'll check back and see how things are going in a couple of months.
Thank you both. Good morning to you.
All right, and we'll post a link to details about the defense authorization bill and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.